Job chapter 3. After this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. And Job said, "Let the day perish on which I was born, and the night that said, 'A man is conceived.' Let that day be darkness. May God above not seek it, nor light shine upon it. Let gloom and deep darkness claim it. Let clouds dwell upon it. Let the blackness of the day terrify it. That night, let thick darkness seize it. Let it not rejoice among the days of the year. Let it not come into the number of the months. Behold, let that night be barren. Let not joyful cry enter it. Let those curse it who curse the day, who are ready to rouse up Leviathan. Let the stars of its dawn be dark. Let it hope for light, but have none, nor see the eyelids of the morning, because it did not shut the door of my mother's womb, nor hide trouble from my eyes. Why did I not die at birth, come out of the womb and expire? Why did the knees receive me, or why the breast that I should nurse? For then I would have lain down and been quiet. I would have slept, then I would have been at rest with kings and counselors of the earth who rebuilt cities for themselves, or with princes who had gold, who filled their houses with silver. Or why was I not as hidden stillborn child, as infants who never see the light? There the wicked cease from troubling, and there the weary are at rest. There the prisoners are at ease together. They hear not the voice of the taskmaster. The small and the great are there, and the slave is free from his master. Why is light given to him who is in misery, and life to the bitter in soul, who long for death, but it comes not, and dig for it more than for hidden treasures, who rejoice exceedingly and are glad when they find the grave? Why is light given to a man whose way is hidden, whom God has hedged in? For my sighing comes instead of my bread, and my groanings are poured out like water. For the things that I fear come upon me, and what I dread befalls me. I am not at ease, I am not quiet, I have no rest, but trouble comes." So far the reading of God's holy word.
Well, I'm going to read from Ecclesiastes chapter 6, and it's an opportunity, boys and girls who maybe want to have a worksheet, I think you can go and get that at this point in the service. But we're going to read from Ecclesiastes chapter 6. You'll know that in this book, the way we've been looking at it and structured, we've seen there was an introduction and there is a conclusion to the book, a prologue and a paragraph at the end. But in between, from chapter 1, verse 12, we've structured this study, if you like, of Ecclesiastes, looking at four great sermons. And we've already looked at the first two sermons. We looked at chapter 1, verse 12 to 3:15, and last time we finished off the second sermon, chapter 3, 16 to 5:20. And we saw in those sermons that there are usually two very distinct paragraphs. The first one is under the sun. You'll see that little phrase, and it means living life here on the horizontal without looking up or outside of ourselves. And then we've seen that the writer, the wise man of this of Ecclesiastes, then talks about God at the second part or the end of his sermon. So these two distinct phases in each sermon. And as we start to look at the third sermon in chapter 6, verse 1, goes right through to chapter 8, 13, we'll be looking at chapter 6 tonight. And it has that same theme. And so we'll be looking at the under the sun theme, but it's slightly different to the previous two, and we'll see that as we go through. So we've seen that the overall summary of Ecclesiastes is it's about a brief life in a fallen world before a sovereign God. We live our brief life in this fallen world under, not just the sky, but under the sovereign Lord. So let's read together chapter 6. "There is an evil that I have seen under the sun, and it lies heavy on mankind. A man to whom God gives wealth, possessions, and honor, so that he lacks nothing of all that he desires, yet God does not give him power to enjoy them, but a stranger enjoys them. This is vanity. It is a grievous evil. If a man fathers 100 children and lives many years, so that the days of the years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with life's good things, and he also has no burial, I say that a stillborn child is better off than he. For it comes in vanity, and it goes in darkness, and in darkness its name is covered. Moreover, it has not seen the sun or known anything, yet it finds rest rather than he. Even though he should live 1,000 years, twice over, yet enjoy no good, do not all go to the one place? All the toil of man is for his mouth, yet his appetite is not satisfied. For what advantage has the wise man over the fool, and what does the poor man have who knows how to conduct himself before the living? Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the appetite. This also is vanity and a striving after wind. Whatever has come to be has already been named. And it is known what man is, and that he is not able to dispute with one stronger than he. The more words, the more vanity. And what is the advantage to man? For who knows what is good for man while he lives the few days of his vain life, which he passes like a shadow? For who can tell man what will be after him under the sun? We end the reading there at the end of chapter 6. And so we've already seen the wise man who wrote this book. He introduced us to his search for meaning in life, that this brief life in this fallen world, is there meaning? Does life have meaning? Does it have purpose? And we saw in chapter 1, he looked around at the natural world and didn't find any help there. He looked back in history, and he also looked around him and looked within him, looked within his own experience, and he looked at wisdom and having intellect and education. He looked at enjoying pleasures. He looked at having a preeminent place in the world, a position, a place of authority or a place of position in this life. He looked at hard work. Maybe if I throw myself into hard work, that's where I'll find meaning to life. And we saw that he came up with this answer that this life is all vain. It's vain. It's passing. It's passing. We looked at the first sermon and saw that really he tasted all these things. But then at the end of the sermon, he realized there was purpose with God. We saw that, didn't we, in chapter 2, verse 24, and to the end of chapter 3, verse 15. He said, there is purpose with God. Whenever you acknowledge and look up from living under the sun and look up, you see there's purpose with God. In the second sermon that the wise man gives us in chapter 3, 16 to 5, 20, we saw that, again, he looks around, he saw there was no justice, there was just oppression, no justice in this world. That again, he said, is work the thing I should look at and to find meaning? And he just found there was loneliness, there was no friends in this life. You could have power, you could have popularity, but they all ended up as being empty. But then he looked and he saw the meaning to life is found when we worship God. And so when we realize that there's purpose in this world that comes from God, and that when we worship God, then our life has meaning. And we have looked also last time at chapter 5, verses 8 to the end. And we saw the second part of the second sermon that he gives us. Again, he looks around and sees just vanity and meaninglessness. But then he saw that everything, verses 18 to 20 of chapter 5, is gifts from God. When we acknowledge that everything is a gift from God, then we have found meaning. Life is worth living. Life has purpose. And so as we come to Ecclesiastes 6 tonight, and we look at these verses 1 to 12, I just want you to ask, well, what do they reveal to you so that you realize life is worth living? What lessons are there here to see that there's purpose and meaning to life? And these verses focus particularly, the wise man would ask us to focus particularly on wealth. On wealth. So we're going to do the same thing. We're just going to look at the vanity, living under the sun, and then look at some things about God towards the end. So vanity, chapter 6, verses 1 to 9, living under the sun. There are two inescapable realities in this life, aren't there? And you know what they are, death and taxes. Both are present here in this chapter that we've read. Death is maybe lurking more in the background, but wealth is really to the fore. Money, and not just taxes, but wealth of every type. He talks about goods in verse 10 of chapter 5. He talked about food and drink, didn't he? Also, in verse 10 of chapter 5. He talked about goods in verse 11 of chapter 5. He talked about food and drink in verse 12. He talked about many riches also in chapter 5, 13 and 14. And we're surrounded by this wealth, and particularly in this part of the world. We are surrounded by wealth of all sorts, of all forms. And if the book of Ecclesiastes tells us nothing else, you will not easily forget the truth, will you, that there is nothing new under the sun. Apparently in Syria, in an ancient civilization in Imar, there has been a tablet and a story excavated, and this is what the tablet excavated was about a son who was listening to advice from his father many centuries ago. And this son was listening to fatherly advice about accumulated wealth that must be left behind when you die. And this is what the son concluded after listening to his father's wisdom. He said, "What really matters is what one can enjoy in the world of the living, because what happens in the afterlife is beyond human understanding." Now, that's not a Christian speaking, he's not a believer, but he gets the point that this idea of pursuing wealth and trying to find enjoyment and satisfaction in it and in other things, it's nothing new under the sun. You can go back to ancient Syria and many other civilizations, and the same question of wrestling over wealth was being wrestled with by people then. Now, previously we saw in chapter 5 what we call the problem of stuff or the futility of wealth. And I just saw on the ABC news bulletin, there was a little bit on their news this week about the problem of stuff in Australia. Do you know how much stuff is stored away by each of us on average? $163 of stuff is stored away in barns and storage rooms. Most of it's furniture and other things. I wonder how much you've stored away. But stuff, wealth, is a problem. We're surrounded by it in this world. We buy so much that we haven't room to keep it all. So what do? I remember last time we saw with the problem of stuff in chapter 5 that one never has enough. Chapter 5, verse 10, so it leads to dissatisfaction. Remember, he saw also in verse 11 that even though you have all this stuff, others are going to collect it or benefit from it in the end after you've died. And what does stuff cause? Well, he said in verse 12 of chapter 5, it causes sleepless nights. So why do we get so worked up about accumulating wealth, accumulating treasure and honor? And so as we look at the first few verses here of chapter 6, verses 1 to 9, he's looking at wealth again, the wise man, and he's coming up with some conclusion he's learned from observing what he sees about wealth in the ancient world. It's just as true today as it was back in the days of the writer, back in the days of ancient Syria. And what does he tell us? Well, he speaks first of all about enjoyment in verses 1 and 2. Do you get to enjoy your wealth? Or rather, he speaks here about no enjoyment. He says people get wealth, but they don't enjoy it. This seems to be the common experience of men and women. That's not my advice. If you look at verse 1, it says, there is an evil that I have seen under the sun, and it lies heavy on mankind. It lies heavy on mankind. There seems to be a common experience of all human beings, whenever they live or wherever they live. They have riches, but no enjoyment. This is the truth that bears heavily, that weighs heavily upon us, that we do have riches. And when we do have riches, we don't get full enjoyment from them. The person in view here in verses 1 and 2 has wealth. They have possessions. They have honor. Yet they have no enjoyment of them. This thing that lies heavily on mankind, a man to whom God gives wealth, possessions, and honor, so that he lacks nothing of all that he desires, yet God does not give him the power to enjoy them. He has all these things, but he doesn't enjoy them. So what are some of the things we can learn about that? Well, one of the possible reason that the wealthy man or the person who has possessions, and it could be you, it could be me, the most likely meaning that they don't have enjoyment is that the wealthy man dies before he gets to fully enjoy the fruits of all his labor and toil in this life. You work all your life and then you die. How many people work hard and look forward to retirement, and you see all the adverts. I don't know if you watch TV in the mid-afternoon and quizzes. There's not much on, but there are lots of adverts about how glorious old age is and the homes you can go into and so on. And that's what we work towards. But what happens if we die at 65 or before that? We don't get to benefit from all of the fruits of our toil. You may acquire much, but do you get what you desire? You don't get what you desire, which is joy, and to enjoy them. Other less likely reasons, possible reasons, commentators say that people may not get to enjoy their wealth is that maybe you lose the wealth in a bad business deal, a bad transaction. And again, we saw that last time in verse 14 of chapter 5. You can enter into a business deal and you can lose all your money. What are you? Are you a shares person or are you a bricks and mortars person? Or do you hide it under the bed? It doesn't matter which one you choose. You can lose it wherever it is, whether it's in a bank or whether it's in a house or whether it's in under your bed. You can lose it all. Or as if you read Job chapter 1, which we read last time we preached on Ecclesiastes, you can lose your wealth. It can be stolen from you or through a catastrophe. Just go back and read what happened to Job, the wealthiest man in the East. And remember that the principle we saw last time, that all of wealth, everything we have, is a gift from God. And it's only when we look to God that can there be enjoyment. God provides all things, including our wealth and possessions and honor. And enjoyment also is God's gift. Not only does he give us stuff, but he gives us the enjoyment. And it's only as we know God can we know enjoyment in stuff. So the writer here talks about enjoyment, and he's saying, under the sun, without reference to God, you will not enjoy the things of this world. The second thing he speaks about in verses 3 to 7 is satisfaction. Satisfaction. I don't know if you ever see in the news or watch or have been to a funeral and you listen to the eulogies, usually of family members or close colleagues, work colleagues, and people who've known the deceased. What are some of the common things that they say about the person? He lived for his family. He was a good family man. He lived a reasonably long life. In fact, he lived a very long life. And in that long life, he lived a useful life. One of service to the community, to his neighbors, to his friends. You know, it's possible to live many years. And it's possible to have a happy family life, even to have many children. And that's the situation here. Look at verse 3. If a man fathers 100 children and lives many years, so that the days of his years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with life's good thing. You can have many children, you can have 100 children. I don't know how that's possible unless we believe and don't believe in monogamy. But here he's saying, think of a man, he's got 100 children, and they're all well behaved, and he has a good life, and he lives a long life with all of these children, and they love him, and they give him birthday presents all the time, and he's spoiled by them. He lives a good life, a long life. It's possible to have all of these in one's life. Maybe not only to have many children and a long life, but also to have wealth and possessions and honor, and yet to have no satisfaction. Not to be satisfied with that. The man pictured here had a big family and a long life, as we said. It says in verse 3, he had no burial. There's a lot of debate among scholars what that means, but probably the context best has the idea that that he's trying to just use this as an illustration. Say, just imagine a man who lived so long that he had no burial. And you go on and on and on and on and on and on and on for living. And you still have no satisfaction. Or again in verse 6, this man is a man who lived 1,000 years twice over. Do you know the age? Anybody know, any of the boys and girls even know who the oldest man in the Bible in the world ever is? Anybody know? Methuselah, yeah. Anybody know how long Methuselah lived? It's actually quite easy to remember. It's 969, 969 years. He didn't live 1,000 years, but here in this passage, imagine a man who lived twice that, more than twice that, he's saying in verse 6. More than two times as long as Methuselah. And you can live that long and have no satisfaction. See, he lives 1,000 years twice, and yet it says in verse 7, all the toil of man is up for his mouth, yet his appetite is not satisfied. So we can live long, we can have a beautiful family, a big family, but and all the wealth and honor of possessions, and yet have no satisfaction at the same time. Remember last time we looked at how much is enough to have, how much is enough. You remember the person came to the richest man who was John D. Rockefeller and asked him one time, how much money does it take to satisfy a man? Do you remember Rockefeller's answer? Rockefeller, who's even by today's standard, we reckon he's the richest American ever, possibly the richest person. Rockefeller simply replied, just a little bit more than he has. How much do you need? Just a little bit more. Even Rockefeller, just a little bit more to be satisfied. And we're always going after that little bit more, and that's really showing us we're not satisfied. But here in this passage, the question is not how much is enough, but how long is enough? How long a life would you want if you could live, choose how long you lived? How long could you live? There are many novels written about this and so on. And one of the things is that as you live too long, you've no more friends left. They've all died off. And you just go through eternity almost, or go through history, living and having to reacquaint yourself with new places, new people. How long is long enough? The Chancellor of Germany after the Second World War, Konrad Adenauer, who's a colossal figure in post-World War II Germany. He was told by his doctor this one time, the doctor said to Adenauer, I'm sorry, sir, but I can't make you any younger. And Adenauer's reply apparently was, don't worry, just help me get a bit older. How long is enough? How long is old? How long is enough? Just a bit more. Just a bit older. Let me just be a bit older, so they don't die. And so what we're seeing here, whatever you have in this life, when we just live for these things, even for good things like family and working hard and so on, it does not bring satisfaction deep down in our hearts and soul. And the wise man here uses another illustration of that, doesn't he? He has these illustrations of such and such is better, it would be better than. And here's another of the wise man's better than comparisons. We saw one in chapter 4, verse 2, didn't we, where he said that the dead are already better off than somebody living with the frustrations of this world. And chapter 4, verse 3, he said the unborn are better off than people living with the frustrations of this life. And here in chapter 6, verse 3, he talks about the unborn. The unborn are better off than the living. Why is that? Well, it's because the unborn don't have to endure the frustrations of this frail, fleeting life. The point is that it's of both the long-lived man and the stillborn child end up in the same place. Now, this is not a theology of the afterlife. He's using it as an illustration. But he's saying the unborn, isn't born, but he will end up in the same place as the rich man who lives a long time and has 100 children, but he has to go through all the frustrations of this life. But they're going to end up in the same place. Better off not to have to go through this life, because it's a life where there's no satisfaction. No satisfaction. And there's possibly a proverb used at the beginning of verse 7, which says, all the toil of man is for his mouth, yet his appetite is not satisfied. He's simply saying, we can put all our efforts into satisfying the physical, into satisfying our body, but our souls are never satisfied. There's no deep down, true, real soul satisfaction, is what he's saying. And so the wise man is saying there's no enjoyment, there's no satisfaction. In verses 7 to 9, he talks about contentment. Contentment. There's another proverb used here, and it's at the beginning of verse 9. It says, better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the appetite. It's probably a proverb taken from everyday use. And I don't know if you've heard the proverb in English. It simply says, a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. You know what this proverb means? You've got a bird here. You've got the bird. Just enjoy the bird. Don't be thinking, well, if I could just go to the bush, there might be two birds there. And it's about discontent. We also say, don't we, in English, the other man's grass is always greener. What are we doing? Well, we're mowing our lawn, and we're doing a good job. And then we look over the fence and say, wow, look at that. That's much better. We have a beautiful garden, we have a beautiful house, we have a beautiful wife, many children, and much. But look at he's got. It's discontentment. And here is the mark of life here and now. There's no real contentment, no lasting enjoyment, no deep down soul satisfaction. That's what the writer is saying here. And as he says that in verses 1 to 9, then he introduces us to God in verses 10 to 12, although you won't find the name of God mentioned there. But what does he tell us about God? Well, verses 10 to 12 actually act as a bridge in the book of Ecclesiastes, and they act as a bridge in two ways. It's a bridge into the second part of this third sermon, which goes to chapter 8, verse 13. And although God is not specifically mentioned, these verses point very clearly to God when you read them. But there's also a change in tone in these verses. And so they act as a bridge in emphasizing a difference in the way the material is presented to us in the book. And we'll see that in a moment. But what do these verses 10 to 12 just teach us about God? So that we can know enjoyment, so we can no satisfaction, so that we can be content in this life. Well, verse 10 tells us that God is the creator. Whatever has come to be has already been named. The reference to the past, whatever has already been named, points us back to God's naming of all things, doesn't it, in Genesis chapter 1? And in so doing, it highlights the fact that God is the one who brought all things into being, and God named those things. And he is the creator. He's the only one who has sovereign authority. He's the only one who is eternal, who existed before anything that we know existed, who stands outside of heaven and earth. There's also a contrast between God and Adam in the little phrase which says, It is known what man is. Man knows. Human beings know what they are. Adam knew what he was. Adam knew he was finite. Adam knew he was weak, and in due course he knew he was a sinner. Isn't that why he and Eve hid from God when he came into the garden? God is perfectly strong, but there are limits to man. God is infinite in his being, wisdom, power, holiness, justice, goodness, and truth. Man is finite. Another Bible commentator said here about verse 10, it's about God has spoken. God names all things. God is the one who speaks. And so we see here the God who is the creator. But we also see in verses 10 and 11, God is sovereign. God is sovereign. It says at the second half of verse 10, what man is, and that he is not able to dispute with one stronger than he. Some people think that reference to something stronger than man is a reference to death, but most commentators take it as a reference to God. Who is man to dispute? Who is man to stand up to God and say and argue with God? And verse 11 could be another proverbial saying about using lots of words. It says, the more words, the more vanity, and what is the advantage to man? The more the number of words, the more the words come, well, the more they just turn into vapor. The more they disappear into the ether. We have a phrase for it in English, don't we? Hot air. A lot of hot air. I wonder, do you know any people who speak too much? Talk too much? I'm not asking you to answer that. It's a rhetorical. Somebody who uses too many words. Somebody who never listens. Somebody who talks and talks and talks. What do you do when somebody talks and talks and talks and talks? You switch off. You don't listen. What happens to the words? Well, we also say they go in one ear and out the other. And actually, they don't. They disappear into the ether. It's all hot air. And here's a picture of mankind. That they just speak words and they investigate things. And how many words are written in books and spoken and used briefings and by world leaders and by ordinary people. How many words are spoken? The world is full of words and books and tablets, and now we can store so much only on our laptops and so on. But it's all words and all hot air. God is the one of sovereign authority. What about these people who say when they get to heaven, here's the list of the things they're going to ask God or they're going to tell God? It's all hot air. God is the sovereign one. God is the one who is stronger than man. And so the wise man tells us that God is the creator. He tells us that God is sovereign. He tells us also in verse 12, if we can see it, that God is all-knowing. There are two questions asked in verse 12. For who knows what is good for man while he lives his few days of this vain life, which he passes like a shadow? Who knows what is good for a person in this life? God. God's the answer. It's like that joke or illustration we have about children's addresses, isn't it? That if you don't know the answer, you just say the answer is Jesus. Well, here, the answer is God. It is God. Who can tell us about this life? God, and only God. And the second question in the verse says, for who can tell man what will be after him under the sun? So who can tell you what will happen in the future after your life and in the future? Well, who can tell you what's going to happen in 2023? God can. God can. Because God has got all knowledge and God has got all wisdom. And so as we come just to the conclusion, we notice that there, from here, there will be a slight change. in the tone of Ecclesiastes. Up until this point, the wise man has been looking around and looking and observing, and he's been looking at things. He's been looking around him, looking back in history, looking into his own experience and the experience of the world. He's been observing and giving his opinion on that. But from now on, we're going to see that Ecclesiastes is a bit more like the book of Proverbs. We're going to see wise sayings one after the other. Particularly, just go and read chapter 7, for example. We're going to see lots of wise sayings. So we move from a difference in tone of from looking and observing to listening. The wise man moves from observing life as he sees it to listening to God. And the focus, you see, is on God here in this third sermon. It's on the God who knows all things. That's on the knowledge of God. And with that, it's on the wisdom of God. And so we are going to see as we pursue this little book further and as we pursue this sermon more, that we need to listen to God. Do you want to know if there's meaning to life? You need to listen to God. Not all the hot air around you. Not your own opinions from your own experience. You need to listen to God. For He is the all-knowing God. He is the God of all wisdom and truth. And so as we've come to this point in the book of Ecclesiastes, we have seen that is there life, is there meaning in life? Is this life got purpose? Yes. If we look up from under the sun and look up to God, we see that there is purpose with God. We see that there is worship of God. We've learned that there are gifts, all good things come from God. And here we see there is knowledge and wisdom of God revealed to us. And we need to look in those places to see the wisdom and the knowledge of God, to see that life has meaning. And again, let me remind you, what is the outcome? What is the end goal of all of this? It's not just that you look at God, but it's that you fear God. You fear God. Isn't that what it says in chapter 12, verse 13? The end of the matter, all has been heard, fear God and keep His commandments. That's why we observe God. That's why we listen to His word. That's why we listen to His knowledge and His wisdom, that we might fear Him. And as we have seen, fearing God in the Old Testament is the equivalent of believing Him, believing in Christ, and throwing ourselves wholly upon God. Having faith in God through the finished work of Jesus Christ, that's what it means to fear God. Being obedient followers of God for the whole of our earthly sojourn, our whole earthly journey, that is what it means to fear God. May we see that the things of this life will not bring us joy or satisfaction or contentment in themselves, even if we have them for 1,000 years or more, twice 1,000 years. We'll only find joy and satisfaction and contentment when we look up and acknowledge God and believe in God and serve God. Let us pray.